I'm Kent. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Kent.
And I am from Montgomery, Alabama. Not originally. It's probably not hard to guess. Want to say congratulations to 34 years. That's pretty awesome to have a convention like this going on, our conference, for 34 years. I want to thank Linda and the committee for inviting my wife and I to come out here and speak. I know Linda's been trying to get us out here for about 3 years, but we had some scheduling difficulties. But it's been absolutely wonderful. We drove from Montgomery down to Eufaula, Albany, to Waycross, to Brunswick on 82, which is a beautiful, beautiful ride, except for the love bugs that were committing suicide on the windshield. But it's an honor and privilege to be here, and I really appreciate it. I want to tell you my sobriety date is September 18th, 1998. By the grace of God, good sponsorship, the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, I haven't found it necessary to take a drink or a mind-altering substance since that day. I got some good news, and the bad news is, the good news is I have recovered from a seemingly hopeless state of mind and body. The bad news is I have not recovered from being me. That took me a lot, and you'll hear that's pretty big in my story. For the longest time, I thought my problem was drinking, right? And I would put the drink down, and things would go okay, and then things would go bad. You know, and it took me a long time. It took me about 8 years to really get the first step that my problem was not drinking. My problem was me. And I did that in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, which you'll hear. I hit a bottom in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. I just want to tell you, a little bit about, what I was like. I don't like to dwell on it. If you're here at an AA conference, you probably know how to drink, and if you get asked to speak, it's probably a safe bet that we know how to drink too. I was born May 18th, 1962 in Tokyo, Japan. My dad worked for the CIA, and that's what they were doing over there. I grew up in an upper-middle-class family. I have a brother that's 13 months older than me and a sister that's three years younger. My parents are not alcoholic. They're still married to each other. They live up in Washington, D.C. There's no alcoholism in my immediate family. There was no physical, sexual, emotional abuse in my family. My brother and sister are disgustingly normal. And I just, I do know I had there was a genetic gene in my family, and I got it, and I drank myself into alcoholism. And it happened really, really quick. Like a lot of people, I never fit in. I mean, I definitely remember that from as early as kindergarten and first grade. There's just something different for me. I just didn't feel like I belonged even in my same family. I grew up in Japan and then Taiwan, then Switzerland. And I went to high school in Singapore, so I wasn't exposed to a lot of English TV, and I read a lot of books. And that was my first escape from reading. Reading's a great thing, but even like from the age of six, I was reading because I didn't like who I was, who I was with, and where I was at. So I read all the Louis L'Amour books, and I'd read books about the mountain men, then later on the spy novels. But it was always about being somewhere outside of my head for where I was physically at. I was always looking for something different. I used to always have a big sibling rivalry with my brother. I'm a 50-year-old now. I'm 5'5", and this morning I weighed 137.8 pounds. So you can imagine me like in seventh grade, I think I was, 4'2", 70 pounds. And my brother, I used to have asthma really, really bad. In fact, I was given the last rites by a Catholic priest when I was three. I was supposed to die. And so up until the time I was 12, I had asthma really bad, and I was very, very infirm kid, and I really couldn't play a lot of sports, and I had to be protected and stuff like that. And then I grew out of it. But my brother was a year older. In eighth grade, he was 5'10", 180 pounds, and was shaving in eighth grade, right? I shaved on my 18th birthday just because it was time. I didn't need to, but, maybe that's what the beard's about, right? I can do it. But I say all that, because the first time I picked up alcohol, I was 14 years old, and we had just moved to the Republic of Singapore. I did not have a spiritual experience when I had my first drink. I did not get drunk. I was one of those kids. I was neither extroverted nor was I introverted, right? I was just kind of in between. But when I had that drink, I was with a bunch of guys I didn't know, I had just met, and I do remember feeling part of. Okay, because I was always comparing myself. I was always better than you or not good enough. A lot more on the not good enough side. And the alcohol just made me feel fine. And I drank throughout high school. I did not have a drinking problem in high school. I had my first blackout on my 18th birthday, but I blamed that on tequila. When I graduated high school, I was going to college. But by the time I graduated high school, I was student body president. I was class favorite. I was king of the junior senior prom. You know, as the Al-Anons say, I was a young man with potential, right? And that was in June of 1980. And I went to University of Northern Arizona in Flagstaff, Arizona. I wanted to be a forest ranger. And I did not know that forestry is actually a science degree, because I'm kind of a liberal arts type of guy. History, social studies, foreign languages. I'm not really good at math or the hardcore sciences. Who knew? And that's when fear. I am not an angry alcoholic. I am much more comfortable with fear and self-pity. And fear was a corroding thread throughout my life. It dominated my life. And it absolutely reared its ugly head when I got to college and I found out that I had to take advanced math and chemistry and, you know, physiology and botany. Anything with an E at the end of it is pretty scary to me. And so I stopped going to class. And by October of 1980, I was drinking a gallon of Carlo Rossi Paisano wine before noon. I mean, it happened that quick, right? Happened that quick. It just, boom, I was off to the races. And after two semesters, I mean, you know, I'm not one of those guys that can drink and do great things, you know. I mean, I have friends of mine that have gone through PhD programs while an active alcoholic. I can drink or I can do things, right? It's like pick one. Because once the craving hits me and I start drinking, and I'm a beer drinker, okay, and it's just all I want to do is just get mellow and just leave me alone, right? Just I like to go in my own little world. So I stopped going to classes. My parents pulled the plug on that after a couple of semesters. And I just kind of wandered around for about a year. And then my parents got me an appointment to Virginia Military Institute. And I was there for 2.5 years and I actually did pretty good because there were no women, you couldn't have a car, and there was no alcohol, and they marched you to class. Okay? And that was, it's interesting, that was my first exposure to structured discipline. And what I have found is that when I have discipline in my life, I can actually function fairly well. When the discipline is taken away from me, because I'm managing my life, I'm incapable of it, right? And I self-destruct. And that includes in the program, which you'll hear. But the problem with a 4-year degree is it takes 4 years, you know? And I like what Wayne Butler says, you know, I'm the 50-yard man in the 100-yard dash, you know? I will beat you to halfway, guaranteed, because I'm a go-getter, I'm a hard charger, and then either my laziness or my ADD, you know, look, there's a squirrel, and it's like, poof, and I stop. You know, I stop in the middle of the race. So I left after 2.5 years, and I enlisted in the Army. And I spent quite a bit of time in the Army, different units, different places, did very, very well in the Army. I started to have some things, not externally, but internally, like after 3-day weekends where all I do is get a hotel room and hole up and drink beer. You know, at the age of 23, 24, I'm coming to work on a Tuesday and I'm doing this, right? And I didn't know anything about alcoholism, but I kind of knew that maybe my drinking had something to do with it. But you got to remember, I was 23, 24, I had no consequences, and I was not willing to entertain due to my drinking. Because I worked a lot, but when I wasn't working, I drank. That's all I did was I worked and I drank. Spent a lot of time deployed, which I am convinced is why I'm still here today. We'd be gone 6 to 9 months out of the year where there was no alcohol. And those times when I would question myself with my relationship with alcohol, my idea, like I guess a lot of people, of the alcoholic is someone that has to drink every day, all day, whatever. And I'd be like, man, I can go 6-9 months without alcohol. And it's not white knuckling, right? When I don't have it, I'm not thinking about it. But when we would come back to the base, even if it was 2 o'clock in the morning after we cleaned weapons and turned them in, I could not go to bed until I went to the 24-hour shop and got a six-pack, even though I hadn't had it for 6-9 months. And then once I had it, it was, you know, like a 12-pack a night, and on the weekend it would be a case a day. And so what eventually happened to me is I ended up in the Republic of Panama with the Army, and I was at a point in my life, you know, 27, 28 years old. You know, I'm just restless, irritable, discontent, right? I'm not satisfied. I don't know what's going on with me. I'm doing very well militarily, and just there's something wrong with me. I just wasn't getting it. So I kind of, you know, the people I respected the most were married people with families. And I said, you know what, you know, you're 28, 29 years old, you live in the barracks your whole life or in college. I had a car once, but it got stolen while we were in Honduras. Didn't even file a police report. you know, whatever, you know, I don't need a car. I mean, my barracks is here, the 24-hour shop that sells tobacco and beer is half a block from my barracks. I don't need a car. So I lacked responsibility, right? So I married a Panamanian prostitute I knew with a 7-year-old daughter, right? So thank you. Thank you. My wife and I, when I came back from Africa, my wife and I spoke in an Al-Anon conference in Buena Vista, Colorado. And when I said that, it was just like, yeah, there was nothing funny about Panamanian prostitutes. It's like, yeah, there is. But what happened, that was the beginning of my end, though, because what happened is, like I said, I can't manage my life. And being married, I had to move out of the barracks, and I had things like bills, right? Telephone bills, electric bills, how to budget money. I couldn't do it, right? And that's pretty amazing when you figure some of the stuff I'd done in the military, some of the schools I'd been to, and I was always honor grad or distinguished honor grad from every single military school I'd been to, and yet I could not do things that an emancipated 16-year-old can do. You know, like I said, like work within a basic budget. So as my life started unraveling, because what that was kicking up in me was shame, fear, guilt, and remorse, right? Just like the book talks about, because of those feelings, because I drink for the effect, I would get drunk and do something else stupid, right? Sober up, more shame, fear, guilt, and remorse. They'd shut the phone off. They'd shut the power off. Okay, more shame, fear, guilt, and remorse. I have to drink more. Ad infinitum. And eventually I missed 3 days of work, which is no big deal if you work at Krispy Kreme, but Uncle Sam calls it AWOL, and they're pretty particular. And so some buddies of mine came and got me, and it, like a lot of alcoholics, it turned out that I was pretty much a solitary drinker, so I thought nobody knew. Well, it turns out that my drinking problem, I was the last one that knew. And I went to a 6-week treatment program up in Fort Gordon, Georgia, where they absolutely convinced me to a T that I was an alcoholic. That's where they presented me with the disease concept of alcoholism. I could see all the stuff, said, okay, I'm an alcoholic. So the solution was not to drink, right? I got exposed to the big book. I got taken to meetings. I didn't hear a darn thing, right? Because I'm a self-knowledge type of guy. I didn't know what the problem was. You told me what the problem is. I'm not stupid. I do have tremendous willpower and money aspects of my life. Thank you very much. I'm going to go back to Panama and not drink. Well, I lasted 6 months. Once again, not white knuckling. 6 months later, it's Carnival. You guys call it Mardi Gras here. My wife went into a dress store. There was a Cerveza Panama beer cart there. I had 2 beers, and I stopped. I'm like, maybe I'm not an alcoholic, right? And I had like 2 beers the next day, and then 3 weeks later, I was drunk on duty, okay? And this was 1992, and President Clinton was drawing down the military. And when I went to treatment, I had signed a form. I signed it. I didn't read it. But when I signed it, it said if I had an alcohol or a drug incident within a year, I'd be summarily discharged. You know, and that's what happened. So the military career's gone. And that was the worst point in my life. I have never been as bad as that in my life. I did not stop drinking. I increased drinking. And so anyhow, what happened is that rodeo from 92, I had another 28-day inpatient followed by a 1-year program that was like a supervised apartment deal. I ended up not drinking, getting divorced and going through bankruptcy, not drinking, okay, which is a good indicator for me that I can't manage my life with or with alcohol. That second part of the first step is not saying that my life is unmanageable when I'm drinking, right? That's, I mean, you've probably all heard the hyphen if you understand grandma. It's like break, next thought, right? I'm powerless over alcohol. Oh, hey, and by the way, my life is unmanageable whether I'm drinking or not. So then I came, I took my wife, Corey, hostage in February of 1997. And I was in D.C., she was in Montgomery, and did the long distance thing for a while, and I moved down with her because she had what I wanted, right? She had a job, she had a car, she had health insurance, and she had a house. And she's cute as a button. Yeah. And it's also important for me because even though I'd been to all these treatment centers and I believed I was an alcoholic, I still had a lurking notion, right? Being the self-pitying type. It's like, well, you know, if you had a life like I had, like, what do you mean a life like I had? But the big thing for me is nobody in my family, as far as we can find out back to the 1700s, had ever been divorced, you know. That was kind of a big deal for me. And my marriage was really pretty crappy, mainly because I was in it. And I was also one of those alcoholics that I didn't think I had a problem that money couldn't solve, but my problem was I never had money, right? So I kind of believe that one of the reasons I drank was I had a really bad marriage and I had financial difficulties, right? And if those could be overcome, you know, perhaps I'd be okay. So I moved in with Corey, and she got me a job. She had a really good job, and she managed everything. And I had no financial concerns. And we actually got along very, very well. And I couldn't stop drinking, you know. I couldn't stop drinking. And so what happened is, you know, by September 1st, we got married on July 18th, 1998, and went to Ireland on our honeymoon, so I got to drink in the motherland. And we came back, and what had happened is I'd hit the last stages of alcoholism. I was now physiologically addicted to alcohol. I had drank in the morning for years, truly by choice. I kind of enjoyed morning drinking, but now I absolutely had to drink. I was waking up. Sometimes I was getting the night sweats. I didn't know what it was. Sometimes I thought I was urinating in the bed, and I wasn't. It was just the sweating in the middle of the night. And I would wake up, and I would have to grab a beer, and my hands were doing like this, and it would take me like 40 minutes to drink one beer. So I wasn't living La Vida Loca, you know. I wasn't in the Core Beers commercial, me and the hotties on the beach, you know, with bikinis, snows. You know, one of my most vivid memories is I would always wake up before my wife on Sunday, and I would grab the warm Red Dog beer that I'd hidden in the pickup truck and go into the guest bathroom of the house, away from the bedroom, close the door, put a towel over a warm beer so it would go, and then I would drink warm beer on the toilet, hiding in the house I live in, just so I could go to Walmart, you know, so I could function, you know, so it wouldn't be, dude, what's wrong with your hands? You're pretty young for Parkinson's. So that's what alcohol did for me. And so September 18th, I was unemployed. I was unemployable. My moment of clarity came. I knew what I was going to do to this marriage was the same thing I was going to do to the other marriage. And I was terrified by what was going on with me, because the last couple weeks I couldn't even drink a beer, right? So it's not like I woke up and said, I want to try a spiritual way of life. What had worked for me had stopped working. I couldn't even ingest it, right? So I was out of options. And so I went into what I hope is my last treatment center. And what happened there is I got introduced. I had a counselor that was a recovering alcoholic, and when I was finally honest with him that this was my third treatment center, he's like, dude, what do you expect me to say to you, you know, that you haven't heard before? I said, well, you got $10,000 from Blue Cross Blue Shield. You better say something. And he said, have you gone to Alcoholics Anonymous? And this is the interesting thing, okay? When I was in that one-year program, I went to 5 or 6 AA meetings a week for a year. I didn't have a sponsor, I didn't work the steps, and I didn't have a home group. If you've ever been around AA in large metropolitan areas, in the Washington, D.C. area, there's probably 3,000 meetings a week, and I would just go to different ones because it was interesting, right? And I liked the meetings. Don't get me wrong. I didn't sit in half measures row. I listened attentively. I thought it was great. I thought I was doing AA. I truly did. I thought AA was going to meetings, right? Meeting makers make it. You know, I know I must have heard about the steps. I assume I did. There are people that are sober up there. I know people had sponsors. I just didn't apply to me. And while I was doing that, I seemed to be okay. I lived in a structured environment, had a job, and I went to meetings. But as soon as I moved away, I went back to drinking again. So this counselor said, have you gone to AA? And I said, dude, I've done AA. And this is why I'm so glad he was an alcoholic. Because that did throw him. He's like, really? You went for a year? And he said, did you have a sponsor? And I said, nope. He said, did you work the steps with somebody? I said, nope. He said, did you have a home group? I said, nope. And he said, then, dude, you didn't try AA, right? And I was like, okay. And he said, I want you to go to AA. I want you to go tonight. And I said, wait a minute. Tonight's aftercare. I think we're going to watch a video on cocaine or something, right? And he's like, no, you're going to go to AA, and you're going to go tonight. You're excused from aftercare. And that's what I did. And I asked a man to sponsor me, and he said, okay, no problem. He said, I'm up here all the time. My first home group had meetings 7 nights a week. It started at 8 o'clock at night. He said, be here at 7, meetings from 8 to 9, and stay until 10 o'clock. right? He said, and I want you to do that. I said, I'm going to do a 90 and 90 because I wanted to show him that I was committed, right? And he said, good for you, Skippy. How about going to a meeting a day for a year? And I was like, wow, this guy's a fanatic. but I was afraid, right? I was afraid. And I said, I'll do whatever you want me to do. And so what happened, I got exposed to Alcoholics Anonymous in the big book, and my sponsor sponsored me to the best of his ability, the way he was sponsored. And I took the steps, and I had a spiritual awakening, you know. I took steps that I didn't understand. I took steps that I didn't think would work for me. And it was explained to me that the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, the steps are like a recipe, right? If it's someone gives me a recipe for red velvet cake, and I've never had it, I've never tasted it, I don't even frickin' bake, right? And I don't think it's going to work. I said, I believe this recipe is for pecan pie. I can think that. If I follow the recipe, when I'm done, when that oven goes off, it's going to be a red velvet cake. It doesn't matter what I believe. It doesn't matter what I think. If I follow the instructions, if I have the experience, there'll be a red velvet cake. And that happened to me, and some amazing things happened to me. I was able to go back to college at 90 days sober. I still worked. I had a job that paid for my tuition and books. And I got a college degree, and I got picked up by the Air Force, you know, and all that time I had in the Army that I thought I'd lost when I got kicked out, because I got a general under honorable discharge. I did not get an honorable discharge because of the AWOL and the drunk on duty. You know, they're funny that way. And that was a lot of shame. That was a huge shame because the military was my life. I loved the Army with my heart and soul, and I really felt that I had let them down, mainly because I had, in fact, let them down. So I got picked up by the Air Force, and for the first 2 years I was in college, and I didn't have a security background check. I had a normal background check, but I didn't have a security clearance. And when I graduated college and they offered me a full-time job, they said, okay, now you got to go through a security clearance. And I called my dad, and one of my dad's last jobs, he was head of personnel for the CIA, and he said, son, you can't get a secret clearance. You know, your DD-214 from the military says, right, let me back up real quick. Everything I have in my life that's good has come from the program of Alcoholics Anonymous or Al-Anon. I was in a meeting early on, and I heard a guy from my home group talk about he'd been the guest of the state of Alabama 13, 14 times, right? And when he was doing his nine-step amends, he said he wanted to make amends to the state of Alabama, you know, for his behavior. And his sponsor said, why don't you go for a parole, right? And he did that, and he actually got a pardon from the governor. And so when I heard that, I talked to my sponsor. I said, I wonder, is there a way I can get my discharge upgraded? And he said, shoot, I don't know, man. Why don't you go to the VA? And there's a form. And I filled out a form, and most of the form is they wanted testimonials, right, from people in the community, priests, rabbis, ministers, doctors, lawyers, whatever. And I kind of sat on it for a little bit, but when I filled it out, I didn't have any testimonials from anybody, right? I just put on there, I'm a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous. Since I've been discharged, I have not been arrested. I've graduated from college. I've been employed by the United States Air Force. I'm a productive member of society, and I sent it off. You know, there it is. Just sent it off. And 6 weeks later, whatever, I have an honorable discharge now from the United States Army. But at the time of the conversation with my dad, he said, son, your DD-214 says general under honorable conditions discharge, alcohol rehabilitation failure. You know, you can't get a security clearance. And I was like, man. So I talked to my sponsor, right? And my sponsor is just some schlub from Montgomery, Alabama, right? And I said, man, my dad said there's no way it's going to happen. And my sponsor said, do you think God brought you down this path just to yank the rug out from under you? Do you think he plays like cosmic jokes on people? And I'm like, you don't understand, man. You know, my dad, he's like, this is a God thing. It's got nothing to do. If God wants you to do this, this will happen. He said, fill out the form. It's like a 13-page form. And he said, and don't lie. And I'm like, oh, don't lie. Right? He's like, yeah, don't lie. You know, honesty is the best policy, or rigorous honesty. So I filled it out, and you guys can imagine. I have a secret clearance, and I have for 14 years now. I heard another lady speak, Tammy F. from my area, and she was speaking in my home group. And she talked about she went from GED to undergrad to graduate degree in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. And my wife and I were sitting there together, and I said, you know what? I believe I believe I want to get a master's degree, you know, just for me. You know, there's no money attached to it. There's no job promotion. It was just something I wanted to do, and that was important for me because, like a lot of people, I had self-esteem issues, right? That's what counselors had told me. Well, my sponsor said, well, he said, you know, if you want to build your self-esteem in AA, we tell you to do things that are esteemable, right? It's like, oh, that's a funny concept because I was always trying to get approval from other people rather than do the work myself, right? Or make up stories and have you pat me on the back for stuff I didn't do. And so I was able to do that in Alcoholics Anonymous. I went back to college after my undergraduate while working full-time. I was able to get a master's degree. So I'd say all this just to show that I worked the steps to the best of my ability. I had an experience. I had a spiritual awakening, okay? That which was dead had been awakened. I had a conscious contact with a power greater than myself. And then I stopped. Right? I stopped. Not the meetings, not the sponsoring. But when I said, this is my opinion, and part of the message I carry is to people who were dying in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, okay? Not the newcomers, but the guy and gal with over 1 year sobriety, 1 year, 2 year, three, 14, 17, 24, that have either never had an experience with these steps to find a relationship with a power greater than themselves, right? Or who have and have stopped doing it, and they're dying in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, and all we talk about is the newcomer, okay? I know where I come from, it happens all the time, and I know it happens everywhere in Alcoholics Anonymous because I get to travel. I heard a guy say it absolutely blew me away because I did this experiment. Go to the largest group in your area that has a birthday board, right? And look at all the 9 months and 1 years and 2 years and threes. Where's the sevens? And then there's a, right? We have to carry the message to the newcomer, but people die in Alcoholics Anonymous because the message is not being carried. The solution is not being carried. There's so much watered down misinterpretation that's being carried out there that there are people who have never heard the message of Alcoholics Anonymous, but they're going to meetings, right? And they're not hearing the message in the meetings, and they're dying, and nobody recognizes it because they're not drinking, okay? My book is very clear that drinking is but a symptom, okay? And the only thing that can save me is a conscious contact with a power greater than myself. So what happened with me, right about 6 years sober, you know, we talk about we switch addictions, right? You know, we swap seats in the Titanic. I got into financial difficulty. Now, I'm not talking about, you know, we get kind of cutesy in Montgomery, we talk about retail therapy, right? I got in a fight with my boyfriend, so I bought a pair of shoes. No, I got $42,000 in debt in 2 years buying stuff that I knew when I hit buy wasn't going to make me feel better. I got credit cards, you know, you know how your credit repairs itself in sobriety, and then here come the unsolicited credit card offers? Well, I was taking them, and I was lying to my wife. And I had like 4 or 5 credit cards, and she had no idea. And I had, at this point, I had my own allowance, my own bank account, and it was just letting it roll, right? Let it roll. And I knew I was in trouble. And the way I was sponsored, like I said, through the book, but it was up basically to the 9th step. And then here's what it was explained to me the rest of the program was. The 10th step is I admit it when I'm wrong. The 11th step, I ask God to keep me sober in the morning. I thank him at night. And the 12th step is I go to meetings and I do service work and I sponsor people when I'm asked to. Okay? And that's it. And that's pretty much what I did. And it's no surprise looking back on it and having been exposed to the real solution. At the 9th step, when the promises come true, right, it says, this is but the barest beginning, right? And then the 10th step and the 11th step, it said, you know, this is a lifelong journey. We have to continue. Bill Wilson, in one of his writings, I think it's in Language of the Heart, he talks about AA is spiritual kindergarten, okay? Well, what that means to me, if it's kindergarten, that leads me to believe there's a body of work that I can do the rest of my life with whatever I choose to explore my relationship with a higher power, right? A little bit more than asking God to keep me sober, because that's what I did when I was 45 days sober and thank him at night. It doesn't do the deal when I'm 6 years sober, right? Where is the improve? Where is the seeking, right? How do I improve my conscious contact with my higher power if all I'm doing is the same stuff I did at 45 days sober? The whole spot check inventory in step 10, the 11th step, holy cow, the Nightly Review, Upon Awakening. I'd been to big book studies. I'm sure I had actually kind of shared rather eloquently about it. What I didn't do was do it, okay? So, and I was also, where I got sober was the fourth step. It says do a fourth step, you do it once. Just do one fourth step, right? Well, that same paragraph says a business which takes no regular inventory, but the bottom line, not doing a daily spot check inventory or a nightly review, I'd gone through 6 years of, I had stuff piling back up in my wagon, right, that I got rid of in my fourth and fifth step, because I'm still me, and drinking's not my problem, so I still have resentments, fears, I still have dishonesty, I'm made up with selfishness, I've got all the stuff that's coming back up in my wagon, and for me, it exploded in a financial way. And so what happened is, I am so spiritual, I became honest with my wife when my monthly allowance was no longer enough to cover the minimum balance, okay, the credit cards. Once again, I'm between a rock and a hard place. I have to do something. And so I told her what was going on. And you'll hear her, she knew. I mean, she knew, you know. I mean, she'd say stuff like, wow, where'd you get that gun safe? I'd say, oh, I bought it on layaway. And that's funny, because alcoholics, we're not really layaway people, are we? You know? So she knew, and she'd been working with her sponsor. And her sponsor said some powerful stuff. You need to let him go where he needs to go, or nothing will change. You know, you need to let him go. And so she said to me, and she had a lot of fear of financial insecurity when she married me, which is kind of ironic to marry me. And she'd done a lot of work. And so she said to me, you know, honey, it's okay. It's just money. And that kind of blew both of us away. But she said, what are you going to do differently? Okay. And there's a guy out in California named Scott that I had been listening to for years. And in one of his talks, he talked at 18 years sober, he'd gotten himself an $81,000 in debt. And I said, all right. I said, can you, through the taper community, because my co-wife was speaking a lot, and you know, can you get Scott's number and I'll call Scott? And she did. And so I called Scott out in California. And he said, yeah, man, I'm willing to work with you. He had a terminal illness. But he said, as long as I got, you know, we'll work through this deal. And I told him what was going on. So he said, call me next week. So I called him next week, and I had my big yellow legal pad because I got financial issues, right? And this guy had financial issues. So we're fixing to do some budget work, right? And so he says to me, he says, okay, he said, where are you at in your inventory process? I was like, what? He's like, what's your daily inventory practice? I'm like, dude, I don't have one. You know, now what about this? What about this $42,000 in debts? And he's like, no. You don't have a financial problem. You have a spiritual problem, right? And he said, if you're not doing a daily inventory, if you're not doing a regular annual house cleaning, if you're not asking God's assistance when you get up in the morning, he said, where are you with God? And I'm like, oh, I believe in God. And he's like, okay, good for you. What is your relationship with God? So I asked him to keep me sober. And he's like, how long have you been doing that? I said, well, since I was about 45 days sober, right? And he's like, there's your problem, buddy. He said, what happened to me, it says in the 12th step, having had a spiritual awakening, what was awakened can go back to sleep, okay? How many of you have dear friends in the program that you know for a fact they worked the steps and they got drunk 4, 5, 6 years later, right? This is a one-day-at-a-time program. One day at a time. That's cute in a meeting. I'm sober one day at a time. It says if we do his work and stay close to him, right? It says in the book. Now, you know, it's funny. I hate the terms like big book Nazi and big book thumper. Those are pejorative terms used against people who actually read the book. It says a nightly review. And if you're challenged by this, that's okay. That's okay. That's what, if you're not doing it, I invite you to do it. Because I didn't do it. And it's by the grace of God that I did not drink. So when I got exposed to the inventory process, okay, the spot check, the nightly review, starting my day with some sacred time, okay, some prayer and meditation, absolutely, I can talk to God anytime, anywhere. But there's something special about carving time out of my busy day in the morning for prayer and meditation and time for God, okay? It kind of right-sizes me. There's God, and then there's me. Okay, not I'm going to pray in the shower, which I used to do, or pray on the way to work, which is fine. I'm not saying he doesn't hear. It had about me and my relationship to God. Scott worked with me until he died. And then my current sponsor, the way God works in my life, my wife and I spoke at a conference up in North Alabama. And He was the main speaker, and he came from Denver, Colorado. And I don't think he's been in Alabama since, and he hadn't ever been in Alabama before. And I met him 2 weeks before Scott passed away. And as soon as Scott passed away, when they called me from California, the next day I called this guy, Gentleman Mickey, and asked him to be my sponsor. And this is important. Mickey had never met Scott. Scott had never met Mickey. They don't have the same sponsorship chain, okay? So when I called Mickey, we said, okay, here's what we're going to do. He said, he wants you to do a nightly inventory, right? And that's something, too. Scott, my phone call with Scott, I read him my inventory for the week. I called him once a week. Mickey, you're going to do nightly inventory, and when you call me, you're going to read your inventory, right? And we will discuss what comes up in your inventory and to see where God is at. Where in your life are you currently agnostic? Right here, right now, what areas of my life am I leaving God out of my life? Okay, what's my relationship with money? What are my fears? Okay, all areas where I'm keeping God out of my life that are exposed by doing the inventory process. If I do the inventory process, let me tell you that, you know, that old saying, you know, don't worry about the splinter in your brother's eye, worry about the log in your own. That's what the inventory does. I have enough material working with me to keep my sponsor amused and me busy for the rest of my life, okay? And what's happened, it's been tremendous. As I started this process, you know, I told you I work for the Air Force, and Department of Defense has sent an email out to the civilian workforce saying, with fighting a war on both fronts, we're asking for civilian volunteers with certain career fields to kind of step up to the plate and free up a military guy who can do something else. And so something I felt I wanted to do was part of my amends process to the Army, right? I didn't finish my third enlistment. And it was something I felt I needed to do was to, even though I work for the DOD, I would work as a civilian, you know, a 9-to-5. And I wanted to do this to make amends, right? To give them the best of me, right? Alcohol free, and I can suit up and show up and make commitments. And I talked to my wife about it, talked to my sponsor about it, had the blessing from both. And I applied, and I was applying, man, and I was doing what I do, right? I mean, people, depending on what they had caller ID, oh, not that guy again. And I was applying for jobs in Afghanistan, applying for jobs in Iraq, and nothing happened. It was a four-year, my wife, she keeps track of that stuff. And nothing happened, you know, and I got to learn because I was trying to make this happen, right? And so, well, you know, one evening at dinner with my wife and mother-in-law, I said, you know what? I said, I don't think this is God's will for me, right? I've tried everything I can. I've done the footwork, and then I did some more. You know, I really kind of pushed a lot of buttons, and nothing happened. So I don't think it's going to happen, and here's the deal. I'm okay with it. I got to work the next day, and a lady from the Pentagon called and said, hey, there's a job opening in Djibouti, Africa, and we want you to apply. And I'm like, Djibouti, Africa? Where the heck is that? And they said, well, it's near Somalia, right? And I'm like, okay, that's cool. So I applied, and by Monday, I came back, and I had the job. And I went off about 60 days later. I went to Djibouti, Africa for a year. That's when Linda wanted us to come last year. We weren't sure if I'd be back. And so I got to spend a year with a combined joint task force 4 miles from the Somali border and just doing stuff. And I took over I'm a computer guy. And I ended up, after 60 days there, running a satellite shop, right? And I know nothing about satellites. And I was full of fear, but thanks to God and Google and some really smart people, right, that worked for me, I was able to actually get a lot done and learn a lot and grow a lot as a person. We had AA there. And I went to 3 meetings, and then the other 2 guys got redeployed, and nobody else showed up for like 6 months. And then somebody would show up for 1 meeting. So I basically was without a meeting for a year. And I was fine, right? Because my sobriety is dependent upon my relationship with God. And I started my day with my prayers and my meditation. My wife would send me speaker tapes on thumb drives, right? And when I cleaned my little hooch once a week, I'd listen to speaker tapes on my computer. I ended my day with an inventory, right? And I prayed, right? Because the inventory, I got to say this, the inventory is just a tool to identify the things that are blocking me. The solution is I ask God to remove those things from me. The inventory in and of itself is of little to no avail. It's like they're saying, you know, what's an alcoholic that's just on a fifth step? Is a self-aware, fill in the blank, okay? Because that's all it is. You haven't had the solution in 6 or 7, right? You haven't asked God to remove it. You're merely aware of really who and what you truly are. But you haven't had invited the higher power in to solve the problem. So that was the point of doing the nightly inventory. I couldn't talk to my sponsor, so I would look at that and say, especially at that time, remove the fear from me. I don't think I'm good enough to do the job. I'm going to screw it up. You know, the normal alcoholic fears, right? Remove this fear from me. Help me to see who I can help tomorrow. Help me to be the person you want me to be. And when I left there, I was the only civilian there since 2001 to get a Joint Commendation Service Award. Because Alcoholics Anonymous taught me how to suit up and show up and how to work through stuff when I'm afraid, right? And that's huge, you know. And I mentioned that higher power thing. I don't want to come off like I'm a guru because I actually have to give this tape to my sponsor and he'll probably get a kick because I'm the guy that'll do a nightly inventory. And when I call him on Wednesday, I say, man, I was really, really angry last Wednesday at 9:30 in the morning. He's like, oh, okay. And he said, what did you do? And I said, well, nothing. I inventoried it that night, right? And he's like, no, did you pause and ask God to remove it? Yeah, no. Okay, the next thing, you know, I was selfish. Okay, what time did you know you were selfish? Well, it was 8 o'clock in the morning. Did you ask God to remove it? No, I didn't, right? And that's, he's like, look, here's the deal. It's not the inventory. Don't get me wrong. Doing the inventory is good, but inventorying stuff and not asking God to remove it is going to avail you nothing. It's just, I'll be aware of myself. I'll just be dead, okay? And it's amazing, the guys I've been picking up sponsoring, and the other half, I don't sponsor them. They've just say, I've got a sponsor. I'm happy with my sponsor. Will you take me through the big book, right? And I meet with them an hour a week and take guys through the big book. These are guys 6-7 years sober that have never had an experience with the big book. You know, there's one of my newest AA heroes, Katie and Charlie P. from Austin, Texas. And Katie talks about the ego loves knowledge, right? My sponsor said to me last Wednesday, you can't have a spiritual experience from the neck up. It cannot happen from the neck up, okay? This is not an intellectual program. You know, that old thing, no, it doesn't say in how it works. Rarely have you seen a person fail who has thoroughly memorized our book. You know, and it's important. My favorite meeting of the week, it's Saturday, my home group has a meeting, and it's a literature, right? We start with the big book. When we finish the big book, we go right into the 12 and 12. And an example of this, about 4 or 5 weeks ago, we were on the seventh step. And for 45 minutes, the conversation was about the word humbly, right? Well, you know, it's from the Greek etymology, the root humus, which means the earth. So to be humid, humble is to be of the earth, to be right-sized. Well, yes, but, you know, if you have humility, if you think you have humility, it means you don't have it and all that, you know. And it's like, has anybody here actually said the seven-step prayer? No, but we're trying to figure out what the word humbly means, right? Do you see what I'm saying? That's not the point of it, right? That's why that saying comes from, you can be too smart for AA, but you can't ever be too dumb, right? And that was huge for me because I operate from the brain. I don't operate from the emotions, right? I'm a pseudo-intellectual, and I have to understand things, right? I've got to understand it before I'll try it. I don't like ambiguity, right? I like to know with a fair degree of certainty what the end result is going to look for. And the spiritual journey is completely ambiguous, right? And that's what the whole faith thing, and that's where I'm at right now. Stepping out, you know, leaving the bridge of reason, right? I just enrolled 4 months ago another master's program, but from Loyola University in New Orleans on a master's of pastoral studies, which is really funny. People that really know me just think that's hilarious. But it's part of my spiritual journey, right? I want to learn more about this higher power that I have a relationship with, that I have a burgeoning relationship, right? And that goes back to, says, spiritual kindergarten. If I'm in spiritual kindergarten, there's a whole body of knowledge out there. In whatever faith you espouse, there's a whole body of knowledge, right, that you need to explore. You know, I was telling some folks out when we were out in Wyoming. I don't know about here, but I run into some people like, you know, oh, yeah, dude, yeah, I'm Buddhist. Oh, sweet. I went to high school in Singapore, and I did 2 semesters of comparative Eastern religions. So what is it about Buddhism that you like? I eat hummus wraps, and I do yoga at YMCA. Interesting. Okay? That's cool. That does not make you a Buddhist. But I invite you to go to the library, right? Get some books on Buddhism, right? See if there's a whatever. Explore. Seek, right? Seek. Be a seeker. Find a relationship. To have a relationship means you got to spend some time, right? It takes some work, right? If you date, if you get engaged, if you have a committed relationship, it takes work. It takes effort, right? And that's hard for me because I thought, do you believe there's something greater than you out there? Because I was not an atheist. Yes. Woohoo, I'm done, right? No, it doesn't, the belief, and that reminds me of when, you know, it was pointed out to me when Roland Hazard left Dr. Young after a year of treatment, didn't even make it back to the States, got colossally drunk in Paris, went back to Switzerland, said, what's up? You know, what's wrong with me? And that's when Dr. Young tells him the deal. Well, you know, actually, I think you have the mind of a chronic alcoholic, and I've never seen one of your type successfully recover. And he said, is there no hope at all? And he said, no, actually, there is. There have been few people throughout history that have had vital spiritual experiences that seem to be sudden, rapid upheavals in emotions and ideas and attitudes that is sufficient for them to recover from this disease. And Roland said, good, I'm a deacon in my church, right? And Carl said, yeah, that's not what I'm talking about, right? You see what I'm saying? Because a belief in something is not the same as an experience, right? It's not the same. And the beauty of this program is if you do the steps, you will have the experience. And then from my own experience, I can tell I'm obviously very passionate about 10 and 11, right? 10 and 11. If I do those, I mean, it's in the book, right? I mean, there will people that will tell you, you know, what do you mean you burnt your fourth step? You know, the book says referring to our list. You know, what's wrong with you? It's like, dude, you ever heard about the Nightly Review? Well, that's just in the book. Well, yeah, it's all of it, right? You know, that old saying I was taught early on, Alcoholics Anonymous, what's in this book is not a buffet, right? I really don't get a choice. If I want the results, is not to pick and choose, right? If it's in the first 164 pages, I should probably pay attention to it and at least incorporate it of what works for me the best of my ability if I want to get the results. And that's really all my experience is. As I came in here, I was helpless and hopeless. I worked the steps sufficient enough to have a conscious contact, and then I stopped because I did not, much like our boy Jim, who put the whiskey in the milk. You notice in the beginning of that story, it said he'd been sober on and off several times, and it said he failed to enlarge his spiritual condition. Interesting. That's why he kept getting drunk. He failed to enlarge his spiritual condition. I had a sufficient enough spiritual condition to affect a conscious contact, right? And having worked the steps, I was good. And then I did not enlarge my spiritual condition, right? I stopped seeking. I stopped looking at me. I stopped the inventory process. I stopped relying on my higher power. And 6 years without a drink, I was managing my life. And I got to see that 6 years sober, going to 5-6 meetings a week, sponsoring guys, going to literature studies, doing service work, making coffee. I've done service at the district level. Without me improving my conscious contact, my spiritual condition, I was managing my life. What happened is subconsciously, God, you take care of the alcohol problem. You're doing a great job on that. I'm going to manage my wife. I'm going to manage my finances. I'll manage my career. I'll manage my fears. I'll manage everything, okay? And it, you know, if I hadn't have had the grace to do something different, it probably would have ended my marriage. And then I know I would have ended up drinking again. So it was kind of was humbling. It was very humbling to be exposed to what was in the book that I can't tell you how many literature studies I'd been to. Shoot, I used to listen to Joe and Charlie all the time. You know, been to big book study weekends. Just wasn't doing the work, right? I wasn't having the experience. And it's really, truly, truly changed my life. So whether you've got 30 days in here or you've got multiple years, if you find yourself restless, irritable, and discontent, or if where my sponsor has me live, I just want to read that paragraph on page 52, the bedevilments. We were having trouble with personal relationships. We couldn't control our emotional natures. We were a prey to misery and depression. We couldn't make a living. We had a feeling of uselessness. We were full of fear. We were unhappy. We couldn't seem to be of real help to other people. Was not a basic solution to these bedevilments, right? That's me when I'm not turning my life over to a power greater than myself. When I manage my life with or without alcohol, that's me, right? That's me. And that's where I was at six years sober. So if you can see yourself in there, get with someone that's worked through this book, that's had the experience, and you can have the same experience. Thank you very much. Yeah.